The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
Artists coming together in the restaurant, you know, and Picasso drawing on the tablecloth and all that kind of thing. It's really known throughout history, but it is to do with the solitariness of being in the studio and the solitariness of being an artist, being very much alone. So this idea of coming together to eat is such a nice thing. Mm.
Here we are on an unseasonably wet and cold Saturday in London. But I feel warmed, as I always am, by being with my friend, Tracy Emin. She's a great friend and a great artist. Tracy, over to you.
Okay. So my favorite thing to eat here is the grilled squid with fresh red chili and rocket. 8 medium squid, no bigger than your hand. 6 large fresh red chilies, seeded and very finely chopped. 150 ml extra virgin oil. 225 grams of rocket. 4 tablespoons of oil and lemon dressing. 1 lemon cut into quarters. To make the sauce, put the chopped chilies in a bowl and cover with extra virgin olive oil. Season. Heat a grill until very hot. Place the squid, including the tentacles, scored side down on the grill. Season and grill for 2 minutes. Turn the squid pieces over. They will immediately curl up, and by which time they will be cooked. Toss the rocket in the dressing. Arrange 2 squid bodies with tentacles on each plate with the rocket. Put a little of the chili sauce over the squid and serve with lemon.
I'm so happy that you chose such a classic, typically representative of the River Cafe recipe. And I was wondering why you chose squid, chili, and rocket.
When I go to a restaurant, I always like to choose food that I wouldn't cook myself. But God, it's so easy to cook, so maybe I should do it. And also I'm Mediterranean, so squid is such a Mediterranean food, and I always have this sort of like inner primal thing that if I can eat Mediterranean, eat part of my ancestral food as much as possible. It makes me feel really good when I eat it, so that's why I chose it.
When you say that you're Mediterranean, tell me about being Mediterranean, because I thought you were Margate.
Well, Margate is like...
Is that
yeah,
on Med? I
didn't know. Margate, Mediterranean, Margate. And well, I'm Turkish Cypriot. My dad's Turkish Cypriot, and my great-grandfather was from the Sudan, and he was a slave in the Ottoman Empire. And in around 1900, he was given his freedom in Cyprus with 50 sheep. So we're known as there's a thing called like the Black Turks, and they actually came from the slaves from the Ottoman Empire. And my family on the Mediterranean side is from that background. So there's your Mediterranean. My dad was a really fantastic cook, like amazing cook. Grew all his own vegetables. We actually grew all our own, me and my dad grew all my vegetables on my studio roof back in the 90s, everything. Everything from cucumbers, courgettes, aubergines, potatoes, tomatoes, heritage tomatoes, beans, green beans, everything. And then my dad would cook. So, and my mum was a terrible cook. I hate saying it, but it's true. And the kind of food I grew up on was a kind of strange mixture of like this sort of really amazing food that my dad could cook and this really terrible food that my mum could cook that I really loved.
And what you loved what? Your mother's food?
Egg and chips.
Yeah.
My mum was completely against me cooking. And when we were cooking at school, my mum would actually wrote me letters saying, my daughter will not learn to cook. My daughter is not going to be a slave to any man. But the truth was, we didn't actually have the money for the cooking ingredients. Mm. So my mum, but even so, it worked out kind of badly and kind of good. I didn't learn to cook at school. Cooking at school was pretty awful. And I only learned to cook when I was much older, when I was sort of like around 18 or 19. And even now, I'm not a very good cook, but I really like nice food.
You do, I know.
Yeah, and what I cook well.
Yeah.
So, well, yeah. Well,
that's so interesting that she did not want you to be stuck in the kitchen as a, well, a slave or anyone, as a woman that yeah, was, in a had way, to cook for a man. That we that's normal.
Yeah, but in a way, for that time back in the 70s, it was pretty radical as yeah. well. It was kind of like a strange dichotomy, because there's my father being a good cook and there's my mum being a bad cook telling me not to be a slave to any man.
Yeah, well, was she ambitious for you in every way, apart yeah. from keeping you from cooking?
Yeah.
Did she have very strong ambitions for
yeah,
you?
Yeah, she put me on the pill when I was 14 to make sure I didn't get pregnant. That's pretty ambitious. She's considered the idea of me having children to be a complete failure and not a positive thing. So she did everything to stop me from being a single mother and a young single mother. Whether that's right or wrong, it doesn't matter. It seemed to have worked in my favour. yeah. Mm. And, yeah, she's when I think about it, she was really not... My mum was very cosy person, but she wasn't home-based, really. It wasn't her strong point.
Do you think she wanted to do something else, did she, for herself?
No. Absolutely. My mum was a brilliant dancer. And when she was sort of around 15, she had an interview, audition in a theatre for dancing, and her dad wouldn't let her go.
Yeah, well, there you are. And when you left her, how old were you when you actually left your father's cooking, the deliciousness of growing vegetables how old were you when you left
actually,
all that?
My dad never lived at home. My dad left us when we were about 7 and my mum left us when we were 12 for quite long periods of time. So me and my twin brother, when we grew up, it was very different from other people's backgrounds and it was very impoverished. We were incredibly poor. It's strange. We were very wealthy when we had that growing up until we were 7, and then my dad lost everything. And my dad was married, so my dad spent 3 days with his wife, three days with my mum. We always say one day somewhere else. So, and so when my dad was around, the cooking or anything my dad did was like a big treat.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit betterhelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
There's a lot happening these days. But I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters, without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
My dad came here in 1948 on a £10 ticket from Cyprus. And then my mum's a gypsy, so it's really quite exotic, actually. You know, I was brought up on pomegranates and watermelon and with my dad and while my dad was at home. And then when I was older, I started travelling to Turkey with him. As soon as we could go back to Cyprus, I think I was 20, when the war finished in 1984, my dad took me to Cyprus. He said, baby, we're going home. And that was the first trip to Turkey and Cyprus since I was a baby. And And it was like amazing to be with my dad, to be living with my dad there, cooking everything. And and my mum was kind of a bit pissed off because all that she'd done for me, and then suddenly I'm like, but I'm, you know, I'm my father's daughter.
Your father's daughter. Well, yeah. You started out by saying you're Mediterranean. And so to actually probably go and see the Mediterranean and have the food.
But when we were, up until we were about six, we would go to Turkey regularly once a year. And we spent, when we were really tiny, we spent two periods of 6 months there, once when I was about three or four, and then another time when I was six, we spent 6 months there. And all that time, it would have been Mediterranean food and Mediterranean cooking. And we used to drive to Turkey. And this is really cool. We used to have, in the back of our car, we had a Zodiac. We had these little tiny wooden chairs, you know, with the rapporteur seats. And my dad we had a brand new Zodiac. My dad just stuck a hole through the roof, through the bits, and then got bungee elastic things around the chairs, and then just sat us in the back of the car bouncing up, and we were twins, bouncing up and down on these chairs with those little noddy dogs. And we'd drive to Turkey and we'd stop on the way all the time, and my dad would get the Kalagas stove out and fry eggs and cook and everything, and we'd go to fields and take watermelons and things. So it was really exciting and like adventurous, these drives. And I'm romanticizing about it now, because it is romantic and it was different, and it was different from everybody else's upbringing that I knew. And so we went from that to this, like, to squatting in a cottage and my mum working in a hotel as a waitress and a chambermaid. And so it was like from high to low, really fast, a reversal of fortune.
When you were having to cook for yourselves, did you eat? What did you do? No,
my mum was out a lot most of the time working, and at weekends as well, she'd be out till 3 a.m. So we were on our own, and often my mum would leave us sandwiches and whatever, but my big thing was just like orange squash. And tons of orange squash, and sitting up at night crocheting in bed. And also, for example, like Christmas, like you said about this, a lot of this podcast is about people sitting around the table and remembering it. Oh, there was no sitting around the table for me. It was sitting and watching the telly with a tray with egg and chips, you know, when my mum come home. And Christmas was not Christmas. We didn't have Christmas because my mum was always working. Our Christmas was like a week after and kind of cobbled together, but it was never going to feel the same as the real Christmas. And I remember we had Salvation Army one year, you know, coming around with food and presents because we didn't have anything. My mum, if she didn't work, we had nothing. And that is a very different upbringing to a lot of people I know. And it's not a thing to feel sorry for. I'm just stating the difference. Yeah. And also it was pretty shocking to go from this wealthy thing of being quite spoiled as well in lots of ways up until I was seven, and then nothing.
Zero. So, do you remember being hungry?
Mm.
You do?
Yeah. And I think my mum remembers us. My mum's dead now. But, you know, my mum, this is one of the most shameful things that I have to say, but in a way I'm sort of proud of her. When the hotel was derelict, my mum went climbing on the roof and took lead off the roofs to sell it, so we had something to eat. Mm. And that is on another level, complete different level. And so much of this is down to education, and so much of it, and it's like the cooking thing and education and food. There is really better ways to do this. But when you actually have nothing, and you hear about these people, women shoplifting to get their babies food, and it seems unimaginable, but it's not when you've been that poor.
It's not. And it's happening now. And yeah. We know that it's happening today, and we know that, you know, when children couldn't get to school because of the lockdown, they were missing the only meal they had for the whole day. Oh. You know, very many children only have lunch and that's it.
I'm a big supporter of the Salvation Army, also mentioned earlier. And the Salvation Army were feeding 60,000 people a day, a day. And it's more now. And all of these, I support a food bank in Margate or whatever. It is at a really, really bad level. So, yeah.
When you left, did you come to London at 13?
No, I left school at 13, and yeah. I had to go back to school by law for the last 4 months from Christmas till May. Otherwise, my mum, social services would have been involved or whatever. And my mum didn't mind if we didn't go to school. And I was brought up with absolutely no rules. And I guess this might be slightly the gypsy side of things. No rules whatsoever. We made our own rules up. If I didn't want to go to school, I didn't go to school. I didn't want to brush my teeth. I didn't want to brush my teeth. I want to have sex. I have sex as long as I was not going to get pregnant. All of these kind from the age of about 13, 14. And not going to school was because school was so depressing. It was like, oh, my God, I'd get there and they'd shout at me or this would happen or that would happen. I wasn't doing what I wanted to do. So the last few months when I went back, I just did art for 4 months, more or less 3 days a week. And then left when I was 15 and then came to London. The day I could leave school, that day, the 1st of May, I think it was, I just came straight to London with a bag with 2 David Bowie albums and some clothes.
Where did you stay?
I stayed in all different places. I stayed in a squat in Warren Street, which was pretty educational, with quite a lot of well-known, they're quite well-known people now, very successful people who live there. And I stayed with different friends, different floors. I stayed in a cupboard in Clapham for quite some time. And it's a real mystery how I never really got into trouble but I was kind of sassy and sort of streetwise. So that saved me quite a bit. So I learned a lot and I grew up, but I was always a lot more mature for my age. I don't know why. I just grew up very quickly. I had to. But I don't really have such big regrets over that because it wasn't my fault. It wasn't my doing.
Do you have memories of food and that poverty and that time in London when you first came?
No.
What's your favorite meal in the squat?
Okay, so this is my only squat memory of food at Warren Street. I was only 15 or 16 and I turned up and they were in the basement cooking. A lot of them went to St Martin's and the Royal College of Art or whatever. So it was a good influence in lots of ways. And I was so hungry. And they said, are you hungry, Tracy? I said, I probably hadn't eaten for about 2 days or something. And then they told me they were cooking dog. And I believed them, so I wouldn't eat it. And that was one of my... And when I bring this up in a story, when I see any of them, they always... Yeah, it's not a good story, but that's my only real big story about food.
I think poverty, you know, poverty and food, youth and food, loneliness and food, being, you know, thrust into a world where you don't know where you're sleeping, what you're eating, you know, the lack of being taken care of is fundamental.
And it's true because now I have this thing that I call my war cupboard, and I have one in France in my house there and one in London. And my war cupboard is just full of, like, literally, if there was like a war, I've got enough food to keep me going in tins and tins of sardines and all kinds of stuff and everything. And it just gives me a sense of security. And I really love going shopping for really nice food and putting it in the fridge and looking at it. And it makes me feel so safe and cozy and secure. And it's taken me a long time to realise that I had a hang-up about it. I think probably only in the last few years that I realised how much it meant to me that food makes you feel secure and comfortable. And for a long time, I didn't eat. I used to be so thin and everything. I didn't care about it. I didn't care about food at all for years and years and years. I was very sort of not anti-food, but it just wasn't on my list of things as a priority for living. But now it really is because I understand about my strange relationship with it.
And food and art and food and creating and, you know, the solitariness. I always think of an artist, you know, in the studio working and then going out at night and partying and having food, drinking, being together with other artists. When you were in art school, was that something that you sort of, were you exposed to the idea that you all were painting and working together, there was that whole, what was it like being?
No, when I was at art school, I used to get in late in the morning, getting about 10:45.
Which art school was it?
I went to Maidstone College of Art and the Royal College of Art. I did painting at the Royal College of Art. When I was at the Royal College of Art, I'd get in about 10:45 in the morning and I'd stay to 10 o'clock every night and I'd work at the weekends as well. I had no social life when I was at the Royal College of Art, none at all. I just worked every single day. But the thing about artists and restaurants is brilliant because then, after I left art school, years later, when I think one of the first things I did as soon as I started got money was oysters. And I love oysters. And all of my excess income was spent on oysters. Right. Absolutely.
Where would you go?
Anywhere, everywhere. I'd go, I actually really liked rock oysters, so that was quite easy. In Whitstable, in those days, and you get free oysters for 75p or something. It was amazing. And I used to just try all different restaurants, all different oysters, work out what I like, what I don't like. And I think my biggest moment was I was on about 100 a week oysters.
100 oysters a week.
And I used to cycle everywhere. And I was so fit. And I was just lean. I was sort of like a ballerina, just sinew muscle and just like an oyster diet. I was just like on fire. It was fantastic.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
You have a house in the south of France. What is eating like there? Did you choose it also because it was on the Mediterranean?
I chose it by default, but yes, it is on the Mediterranean. And I'm on top of a hill, looking at, I have a sort of 200 and maybe 260 degree of the sea. It's just behind me that I can't see the sea. And it is really beautiful. And it's in the middle of a nature reserve. I don't have any neighbours. And it's a sort of 25-minute drive to the little town to buy food and everything. So what I tend to do is do one shop in the week, and that's it. Wow. And then I have my war cupboard, and my favourite cooking is when I get down, and I've got a vegetable garden as well, really brilliant vegetable garden, when I get down to the real nitty-gritty, and I have to be really inventive with what I cook. I really love it. Mm. And it's exciting, and it's funny with what I come up with and everything. And I just cook for myself there as well, because there's no restaurants or anywhere to eat near me. And I love the produce there.
Do you grow your own vegetables? Mm. I don't know if you do want to talk about this, but we've all had quite a tumultuous time, but probably nobody, certainly in this room, certainly not me, more than you with your illness. And I think your illness must have affected the way you eat, because it was to do with your digestive system, isn't it? And so did you have to stop eating when you were ill?
Because actually, it's not my digestive system, it's my bladder.
Oh, okay.
So different bag. Okay. And yes, it has affected the way that I eat, because I can't have a full bowel. I can't be, because it affects the stoma and everything. And my diet's completely changed since I was ill, which is quite strange. It's like totally changed.
Tell me, what do you eat?
I eat vast amounts of fish, vast amounts of apples, vast amounts of fruit all day long. Which is not supposed to be good for me, but I eat a lot of cold food. I don't know why, much more than hot food. I eat a lot more lemon all the time because of the alkaline. My diet, and it's not a conscious thing either. It's really subconscious. I haven't even tried. I'm not even thinking about it. It's just what's happened. It's strange.
So you haven't been directed by doctors of what you can and can't eat?
I eat quite healthily. So they when you're coming out of hospital, you see a nutritionist and they tell you this and they tell you that. But I'm kind of quite forward thinking on good food. So when I eat something bad, it's because I really want to.
And when you there are so many reasons we eat, isn't there? Reasons we eat because we're hungry, or we eat because we're in a beautiful place and we want to celebrate, or we eat because we are feeling a certain way and we need comfort. If you needed food, if you needed it for comfort, is there a food that you might reach for? And what would that be?
Totally. Apples.
Apples.
Apples. I eat probably about 6 to 8 apples a day. Apples. Couldn't live without apples.
What kind?
I've forgotten what they're called. They're those pink ones and they're kind of sweet.
Pink lady.
Pink lady, yes. I absolutely love them. I wash them, put them on the breadboard, and I get the knife and I don't cut them equally. I just slice all bits off till I get to the core, so it's all different shapes, and maybe I take 3 of them and I make a big pile on a very beautiful blue Delft plate, and then I sit anywhere and just slowly eat 3 apples at a time that are all different bits, shapes and pieces, and it makes me feel so good.
That's what we want you to feel, Tracy. We want you to feel good. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
To visit the online shop of The River Cafe, go to shoptherivercafe.co.uk.
Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed...
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.